supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, we've long known that stress can be contagious from person to person. Walk into a room with somebody who's very, very stressful, and you'll feel tightening in your chest and kind of a desire to get out of there. But now new research from Germany, the Max Planck Institute, demonstrates that even watching stress on a screen can cause stress in the observer. The author of that study is Dr. Veronica Engert. She's from the Max Planck Institute of Human Cognitive and Brain Sciences in Leipzig, and we're very pleased to have her on the program today. Veronica, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Dr. Tony Buchanan, who's authored another significant study about secondhand stress. He's the principal investigator of the Cognitive Neuroscience Stress Lab and a professor of psychology at St. Louis University. Hi, Tony. Do we have you, Tony?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
And we're pleased to welcome back to our studio Michael Boehm, who's the director of the Penn Program for Mindfulness and one of the nation's leading experts on stress and stress management. Good to see you here, Michael.
Well, thank you, Dan.
We'd love to hear from you about stress and contagious stress. I have a feeling this might have affected you at certain times in your life. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-9499. Michael, let's... I want to... wait 1 second. Tony, let's start with you. You did a study that was published in the Journal of Neuroscience in 2011. In it, you talked with a small group of students and had them observe stressful situations. Then you tested their cortisol, the stress hormone, and other physiologic measures. Tell us what you found there 3 years ago.
Well, in that study, we found that in those students, and these are students who were working in my laboratory, who had signed on to be in this study, when they were asked to observe other individuals under stress, what we found was that when the individual who is under stress, so the person who is giving a public speaking demonstration, the people, my students who were observing them, showed an increase in their cortisol response that was sort of matching in terms of the response of the stressed person. So we've been using this public speaking stress task, as have people around the world, for years, and it's very effective at eliciting stress response in the people doing it, but we had never studied the people who were just observing, who are there really as a prop, for the most part, in order to elicit more of a stress response from the person who is speaking.
Yeah.
That was been the new bit there.
Veronica, more recently, you did a very extensive study with adults. You looked at one party watching another directly, but you also measured cortisol in people watching stress strangers in a video transmission, which is what Tony just alluded to. So what did you find?
Well, we found very similar things to what Tony just explained. What we found was that essentially whether you were watching somebody you were very familiar with or whether you were watching a stranger, you, as the observer, had a significant cortisol response, which means you really had a physiological stress response, to simply watching what was happening to the other person. And yes?
Did either of you collect any data about whether the level of stress response was diminished, whether you're watching someone you're friends with or watching a stranger? Or is it the same level? I'm just looking for, you know, is it dose-related almost?
Well, yes, in that sense, definitely it is. So what we looked at were partners, so people who were in a partner relationship for at least 6 months, and strangers. So either we invited partners to the lab or strangers. And what we found was that in the partner diet, 40% of the observers would have this empathic stress response, whereas in the strangers, it was only 10%. But still, I mean, we were quite happy that we were happy, surprised almost, that we would find this in the strangers even in 10%.
Hmm.
But definitely the response was stronger in the partners.
You observed opposite sex interaction. Why was that?
Simply to make it a less complicated design. I mean, this is definitely, we can try this in all variations in later studies, but for this study, we already had 211 observers with the different manipulations that we did, and we just didn't want to complicate the design any further. It would have meant another good 40 to 60 people in our group.
I'm curious. I want to ask all three of my guests, we'll start with the researcher, about gender differences in stress responses. I'll start with you, Tony. A psychologist from UCLA proposed the following about gender responses to stress, and I think you're familiar with this. He said, males often exhibit a fight or flight response to stress, but females across many species may be better characterized by a more pro-social, quote, tend or befriend, unquote, response. So, you know, what they meant by tending, you know, caring for offspring and befriending is connecting to larger social groups. I wonder what your reaction to that is, Tony.
Yeah, I think that work from Shelley Taylor has really been borne out quite a bit over the years since she proposed that idea. I think that she's led to a lot of the work on social support and what we know about how supportive social interactions, engagements, and relationships with others can buffer the stress response. I think that you know, there's got to be cases in which men hopefully can also have these kind of more nurturant responses as well, but yeah, I think there's pretty good evidence for this kind of gender difference in how we respond to stress and as far as how it relates to this contagious stress is kind of an open question. We're still sort of wrestling with that with new studies.
Michael, you've been dealing with people under stress for decades now. Have you noticed a gender difference?
The biggest gender difference that I've noticed is that women are more comfortable talking about their stress. And since the only way, really, in past decades at least, that we could reliably quantify stress was to ask, you would get divergent scores, different answers based on one's comfort with admitting stress. You know, women in the classes that I run don't seem to be more stressed, but they seem to be more comfortable talking about it.
Yeah, and I wonder if that affects the impact of stress.
Well, there's lots of research to suggest that talking about it or writing about it, journaling, getting it out, offering it to the world, and then seeing what it looks like or hearing what it sounds like is helpful. Although there isn't evidence that I know of studying that based on gender differences.
Veronica, I want to come to you on a statement you made in the summary of your research. There was one sentence that reads, observing stressed out strangers via video transmission was enough to put some people on red alert. Why some people and not others?
Well, we also looked at personality traits that typically, the ability to feel empathic in self-report questionnaires. And what we found was that clearly people who scored higher in traits like empathic concern and perspective taking or personal distress also had a stronger empathic stress response. So definitely there seems to be inter-individual differences with respect to the way that people report about being empathic.
Michael, what's your observation?
Well, I think that information is powerful and interesting. I'm wondering if the people who are more sensitive to contagious stress have closer relationships. You know, as
in general,
as we talk about this more, I'm starting to think that contagious stress is not a bad thing. Maybe it's just a different way of saying that we're all connected.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about not just stress, but contagious stress. There's a lot of evidence now that stress is actually contagious if you're in the presence of someone or even bearing witness to someone who's under stress. You can absorb this almost through your pores. If you're living with someone who is under stress, or you're working with someone, or if someone's constantly calling you a friend, give us a call. We'd like to hear about it, and we'd like to hear about what you do about it. Our number is 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-9499. Please call early in the show. I have a feeling our lines are going to be filled up pretty quickly. We're talking about contagious stress, but Tony, I was really taken aback by the word, and I think both of you have used it today, empathic stress. And typically, the assumption is that empathy is a good thing. It's like Michael just said, it connects us to one another. Tony?
Yeah, it's kind of a paradox. I mean, when we write about empathy in the paper that you mentioned, I do write about it in sort of a broader sense than the colloquial sense of just making the decision to feel bad for others, and we tend to think of it as a sense of thinking about others. But I think, and I think Veronica would agree with this, that the just observing someone under stress or in pain activates several of the same physiological responses automatically in people. So this isn't something that we have to think about or make the decision to do, but at a very basic level, empathy is something that does connect us in one way or another. And there are ways to control that, of course, and there are individual differences in how we respond to others, how we control that response. But I think it is a very basic response of social animals, including humans, to observing someone else in pain or distress.
That's how we've survived as a species. Michael, so how do you teach people to deal with this empathic stress?
Well, it's not all that different from any other kind of stress, that when you look at it closely and understand what's going on, it's not all that scary. You know, the word empathy, the roots of the word empathy come from a German word that I won't even try to pronounce, but it means feeling into someone else. And when you experience someone in distress or stress or any kind of suffering, you don't just notice it in some abstract kind of way. You feel it. It becomes your pain, too. When Bill Clinton said, "I can feel your pain," he wasn't just speaking, abstract words. You feel it in your heart. And so one way or another, people can learn to hold what is hard, to not believe that it means that some disaster is impending, but that it's just a way that they're holding steady while they experience the distress of another, and ultimately it could be an expression of love.
Let's take that information and go right to the phones. We've got Deneen on the line. Hi, Deneen. Did I pronounce your name right?
Yes, Dan. Thank you.
Sure.
So what? It's more of a comment that I wanted to make, which is another interesting pattern. My coworkers, my colleagues, they actually call me in the morning on the ride to work and share their stress prior to even getting to work.
So what impact does that have on you?
I think part of the reason they do it is because I do encourage them to think a little more positively. But I'm really thinking about it now, listening and considering that maybe I am being affected by the stress that they have, that they're sharing with me.
So let me press you on this. You said maybe I'm being affected. So let me come back to my original question with you. What impact is this having on you in the morning? Did it happen this morning?
Yes.
Okay.
It actually did.
All right, great.
It actually did.
Great. That's wonderful. Well, maybe not for you, but it's wonderful for our example. So what impact did that have on you this morning? Start with your body, not your mind.
Okay, so I definitely find myself increasing in heart rate. When I do speak to them, I'm very empathetic. And so some of the stress that they're feeling, I do feel that I become more tense before going into work. And so I do realize that it is impacting me. But at the same time, I feel like if I don't answer the phone and help deflate their stress before they go in, then maybe something, you know, could add to it and they won't handle it well.
Now, so, I am going to take your theoretical model here, which is if I don't do anything to deflate their stress, something bad's going to happen when they go into work. So I'm going to take your theoretical model and hand it over to our clinician here, who's also a physician, and ask, Michael, does that theoretical model hold up?
Well, it sounds like there's some worry there and a thought about how things may be bad or maybe worse or maybe awful. And I bet that those worries aren't completely true. And I also hope that there are moments when you really appreciate and savor how much of a difference you're making to these people, you know, that they feel that you're so helpful that even before they get to work, they're taking the time to call you, and all they want from you is for you to be there and to feel them. Well, that's really a gift that you have, and I bet it's provided you with lots of benefits through your whole life. It sounds like a wonderful thing. And I think that what Dan is hinting or really suggesting is that there also is a time when sometimes you have to say, you know what, I'm not picking up that phone this morning. This morning is just for me. So you need to have a limit and not go past it.
Let me invite you, before we have to say goodbye and take our break, let me invite you to recall a quote from Mark Twain, who said, I've lived with 1,000 tragedies in my life, and a few of them actually happened. Okay. So
very insightful. Thank you
so
much.
Yeah, thanks to all of us and you and Mark Twain. Take good care. We're talking about contagious stress, and as Deneen said, what impact other stress have on you. Of course, I know no one listening to the show has ever been a perpetrator of contagious stress, that we've all been victims. So, but give us a call. We're at 888-477-9499. We're joined by Veronica Engert, who's from the Max Planck Institute, who has conducted a fascinating study showing that we can even feel stress when we watch strangers experiencing stress on a screen. We're joined also by psychologist Tony Buchanan. He's a principal investigator of the Cognitive Neuroscience of Stress Lab at St. Louis University, and Dr. Michael Baim, a physician and director of the Penn Program for Mindfulness right here in Philadelphia. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Support for WHYY comes from Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, welcoming clients to their Center for Psychotherapy in Bella Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute provides effective treatment for challenges including depression, anxiety, stress, and relationship problems. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about contagious stress with psychologist Veronica Engert, Tony Buchanan, and physician and teacher Dr. Michael Baim. We've been talking about, you know, Veronica's study about how we can even feel stress watching stress on the screen, but you know, I'll turn to you first, Tony, that, you know, almost every TV show, murder mystery, detective story, is about stress and its resolution. Without it, there wouldn't be any stories.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, a lot of what we find entertaining is, you know, you've got your conflict and some kind of resolution, hopefully. And I think, you know, There are situations in which we can enjoy that, but there are people, you know, sometimes there are differences in what we find entertaining. So some people can handle watching Breaking Bad, but I've heard many people describe it as being some shows such as that or movies such as that as being too intense. And I think there are many people who enjoy that, but there are those who sort of engage with it too much, and that's one of the components of empathy that we've been talking about, this the ability to, if you some people enjoy that but and can see the distress in others and distance themselves, but others cannot. Others have real difficulty separating what's going on screen from there, and I think that differentiates how we respond in those situations.
So, Michael, some stress has to be good and, you know, bring valuable information, and some stress is just toxic. So, you know, if I'm hearing, you know, an angry dog barking and I see it coming towards me, I'm going to feel stress and get the hell out of there as quickly as I can. You know, I don't want to be mellow and say, oh, there's a barking dog.
Right. If that dog is coming towards you, it's best to leave as quickly as possible.
Good.
There's a reason why this is built into the system. I mean, we didn't decide to have this stress thing happen. Everybody would vote it off the island. But we didn't have a choice. It's hardwired into us because when it's necessary, it saves our lives. It motivates us and channels all of the energy that we have to do something about whatever it is, the saber-toothed tiger that's trying to eat us or the dog that's chasing us down the street. But when we imagine it, when we think about how awful things will be, as Mark Twain said, we kind of live in that awful future, and it's not real. So we've actually created a stressful event, and then we live through the consequences.
Veronica, I'm trying to look at what Michael said kind of quantitatively, and do we have any research showing that there's a point in which, in individuals or in groups, a point at which that stress turns from adaptive to self-destructive? Do we know anything about that?
Yeah. There's definitely, I would say, a lot of research on that. And just to kind of repeat or say another word what Michael said, we want an acute stress response, right? If there is that dog or that bear, we want to have the energy to fight or flight. And this is what the stress response physiologically does. It supplies us with energy for exactly what we have to do, either fight that dog or run away from it. And we can say that this is adaptive, and it becomes adversive, or it becomes unhealthy if it's chronic. So chronic can be different for different people, but essentially, if we are in a state of chronic fight or flight, this is when research has shown that what the stress does with our body becomes unhealthy. So, for example, the increased levels of glucose on long term could lead to diabetes. Increased blood pressure on long term could lead to cardiovascular disease. The immune system could get weakened. So we have all these long term effects of chronic cortisol exposure that won't do us well.
Yeah, there's also here in this country, I don't know if you heard of a study with children, an extensive study of children who were experienced to chronic severe stress. And, you know, it's changing their brain size and structure. These kids are more likely to have life-altering learning disabilities, become depressed, suicidal, break long bones, and have cancer than other kids. I mean, it's devastating on the body. So I wonder, and I want to turn to you, Michael. There's an awful lot of research, and, you know, Veronica and Tony both demonstrated this, about cognitive deterioration with sustained stress. So our thinking is not as sound as it could be or should be. What makes me wonder about that is that's the very organ we need to help us resolve stress, and that organ isn't working so well.
Right. It's really true that at the moment when we need to have our wits most about us, they're not available at all. And so we retreat and revert to old habits and old patterns, and maybe we raise our voice, or sometimes we raise our fist, or we burst into tears, or just storm out. And those are never things that we would choose to do in our most reasonable adult moments. But that reason becomes out of reach.
Yeah, I've been selfish here and hogging the three of you. But we've got a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. Let's start with Carol. Hi, Carol.
Hello. My name is Carol, and I have been a perpetrator of communicable stress.
Really?
I'm wondering if there has been research on customer service workers. I know that when I have to call a customer service line because something I count on isn't working, my computer, for example, you know, and after I go through all the answering the questions the computer asks and being on hold and being transferred and having to start all over and answer the questions again to a live person, I'm frustrated. I don't want to be making this call. And I think that the person I'm talking to must be going through similar things all day with people who don't want to be in the situation they're in. And it just seems to me they would be ripe for study as well as work on how you deal with this kind of stress.
Let me turn to the researchers, because I recall reading something about a customer service person, and I forget if it was which of you, if it was on one of your web pages or some independent research. And did either of you researchers know about customer service people? Tony, Veronica?
I don't know.
I don't from the top of my mind either.
Well, let me tell you, and then I'm going to turn to Michael about this. I recall reading a quote from a customer service worker who said that she loved her job because she was able to help people who were in distress. And if she couldn't help them, you know, she cared for them and about them. And she told them she couldn't help them and made other recommendations. But she loved her job. So I wonder, Michael, if that gives us any insight, and can we generalize about...
Well, the customer service problem or challenge is, I think, a specific example of a more general problem that people who work with others experience, which is called burnout. That when you're working with people who have had serious psychological or physical problems, who have suffered a lot, everything from having been tortured to having a chronic illness to dealing with someone else who's sick, we tend to get emotionally exhausted. And that is the sort of a core symptom of burnout. It decreases our ability to empathize, and it decreases our ability to perform. But it's clear that there's another side of the coin. And as we've been talking about contagious stress, it's been occurring to me that lots of other things are contagious in exactly the same way, like love, like caring, like closeness, like trust. These are things that we feel from others, and when we feel that from others, we share that feeling.
Yeah, all emotions are stressed and are contagious because of the aforementioned mirror neurons. I remember an experience I had years ago that, Tony and Veronica, you don't know this, but I'm a quadriplegic, and, you know, in that context, as a therapist, I see a lot of people with various disabilities. Years ago, a mother brought her son in, who was also a quadriplegic, a new one. He was about 17 years old, and what struck me about this young man was that he was gorgeous. I mean, he was like a Hollywood beautiful kid. And, you know, I listened to their story, and I told them a bit about mine. I showed them around my house to show them what was wheelchair accessible and what that could look like. I showed them to my handicap van that I drive, and they left, you know, at the end, they left and they thanked me, and they both looked much better. So, you know, that was an example of my empathy helping them. But as soon as they left the office, the young man turned and looked at me and thanked me and pushed his wheelchair out the door. And the second the door closed, I began to cry. I cried knowing what that beautiful kid was going to live with for the rest of his life. And I wondered, am I a hypocrite? Was I in denial? Empathy on both sides of the coin. So it really is not black and white here at all. Any thoughts about that, Veronica?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's some very, very exciting new research also from the group of Tanya Zinger here in Leipzig at the MPI that speaks to what you just said. And it goes into looking at the difference between empathy and compassion. So empathy, I mean, we've talked about that, is that we feel with somebody, right? This can be great in case of a positive emotion, but in case of something negative, it can become quite taxing. And then there's compassion, and it's being suggested more and more that compassion is really something that goes beyond empathy, and it's compassion would be the care and motivation to help, and Buddha say it's the positivity applied to suffering. And there's there is some really interesting and exciting new research that shows us that compassion might really be the key to better dealing with the suffering of others, because it, even in the brain, it compassion activates regions that are related to affiliation and that are related to reward. So it seems that it doesn't necessarily reduce the negative feelings that we have when we see other people suffer, but it, at the same time, increases our positivity. So I think really that this could be a clue of how could we learn to not be too taxed by our feelings for others suffering.
Michael, you and I both have a lot of passion about this topic, and I know you've done an awful lot of research in this about even the physiology of compassion, and you see it acted out in your classes and in the workplace.
Well, I just can just agree with everything that was said, that compassion begins with being able to feel what's happening in the other person, but then there's something that's added to that, which is the ability to, even though we're identified with that and we're feeling that distress or that suffering, the ability to hold that in what we could call a bigger space, like not to be trapped in that suffering, but to resonate with it and to care for it. And that is absolutely something added. That's something different, and it comes from the best part of ourselves.
And nothing begets compassion better than vulnerability of the other person. And they do go hand in glove. When you are vulnerable, I feel compassion. It's almost an automatic response. So talk about connection and relationship, and this is how we've evolved as a species, and this is how everybody's afraid we're going to devolve as a species.
Right. You can think about two people who are experiencing the same degree of distress, one really angry and one not, and you just feel how different it feels and how much easier it is when someone lets you in and allows a little bit of that vulnerability to be felt and known.
Yeah, we've got to take a break, and we've got lots of phone calls, lots of people who want to join the conversation. We're talking about contagious stress. Our number is 888-477-9499. My guests are psychologists and researchers Veronica Engert from the Max Planck Institute for Human Cognitive and Brain Sciences in Leipzig. She and Tony Buchanan, he's a principal investigator of the Cognitive Neuroscience Stress Lab at St. Louis University. Michael Boehm is a physician and director of the Penn Program for Mindfulness. Well, you're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation distributes more than $1 million annually in scholarships to southeastern Pennsylvania students. Individuals, businesses, and educational institutions can set up a customized permanent scholarship fund through the foundation and receive tax benefits while helping students achieve their dreams. The foundation helps make it easy by taking care of paperwork and accounting. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about contagious stress, what we absorb from others, with psychologist Veronica Engert, Tony Buchanan, physician, Dr. Michael Boehm, experts all. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Kim on the line. Hey, Kim.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a therapist.
Oh, you don't even need to say any more than that. Go on.
Yeah. Of about 17 years now. And I have had a series of infections, which has become almost chronic, and my last one being pneumonia, and that resulted in extreme stress to the adrenals and depletion of cortisol, which I am, you know, on some remedies for. But I guess my question is, in regard to the work that I do, you know, how much of this adrenal depletion is attributed to that? I have to say I work about 28, 30, almost 40 hours a week at this position. I enjoy my work. I feel more effective than ever. I get good results with my clients. However, I am constantly, it seems, getting sick with one thing or another. I have Lyme's, and that resurfaces every once in a while. I have other viruses also from my past. And
tell me why you're making that connection.
Between my illness and my work?
Yeah.
Well, I just feel, I wonder if it is stressing me in a way that I'm not registering consciously, but my body is telling me slow down or stop, or, you know, I have to say I also do yoga and meditate and do deep breathing and so try to take care of myself in that way.
Yeah, I would think and I would suggest perhaps at the end of the day, perhaps at the end of each session, you just take a few seconds and listen to your body. I don't know. I mean, you know, you're raising a question and then you're giving a solid argument against it.
Mm.
You know, you're saying the opposite. You're saying that your work nurtures you. No, Michael, do you want to weigh in on this as a physician? And
I just agree with what you said. I mean, I think, Kim, that you're blessed, not cursed, by your job, that what you've found is a source of meaning, a way to make a difference, a way to connect with others that is really powerful. I think that if you're paying attention and listening to your body and feeling your heart, that you would know if it was too much. You know, I have a friend of mine, a psychiatrist, once heard me talk about why I thought I had a cold, which was that I was too stressed and working too hard. And she sort of looked at me and said, I don't know, sometimes you just run into a virus and that's all there is to it.
Mm, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very glad to hear you both agree on this. I'm relieved, actually. I do love my work and would hate to think I would have to leave it for these reasons.
Hopefully, you love your body as much as you love your work. And, you know, just hold your body with the kind of compassion we've been talking about. It might not change anything, but who knows, it might diminish your level of distress about what's happening to it. Kim, I wish you the best, and enjoy your work.
Thank you very much.
So I want to ask all three of you a question that I wonder if compassion that we've been talking about can be taught or learned or improved. Any research on that? Let me start with you, Tony.
I believe so. I mean, I'm not familiar with that work in detail, but I know that there's you know, a good deal of work going on in that field, and I know that at the institute where Veronica is working, that there's a good deal of that going on in terms of compassion training, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, thanks for the setup. So, Veronica.
Yes, well, there is definitely research out there that shows that you can learn compassion, and the point, we are just now in the middle of a huge study in which we teach people who have never meditated before, so who are really completely new to the field, who we introduce to this concept and to the ability to have these feelings of compassion and of positivity towards other suffering. Well, I can't tell you about the results just yet, but there will definitely be a lot coming in the months and years to come. And we are really looking at the brain, at brain structure, and at brain function, at health in general, also at cortisol levels on baseline and in response to stress. And so there will be, I think, a lot of answers coming up.
Can we learn empathy and compassion even if we're not born with it? You know, people we label as narcissists or psychopaths, can it be learned?
Is that question for Veronica?
It's for Veronica. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I thought you could read my mind.
Well, I do think it can be learned for most of us. But this is also a question that I cannot answer you with any certainty. But it would be difficult more difficult, I would suggest, for somebody with a narcissistic personality or the disorders to cognitively understand the concept, definitely, but I really cannot tell you about the research out there and how, maybe this I can give on to Michael, maybe he knows more about how empathy can be learned in certain disorders.
Here's what I wonder, Michael. I mean, you talked about the evolutionary brain. So compassion has to be part of the evolutionary formula there. And I, if it's in there somewhere, we have to be able to learn it or relearn it.
To reconnect with that part of ourselves. It's been taught and learned for thousands of years. This is not something new, although it does seem like it's something that has generated some renewed interest in our culture, but maybe that's because we directed ourselves so far away from it. That it is true, I agree with Veronica, that not everybody can learn to do it because not everybody has the inclination. Mm. The way that you begin to feel compassion is, first of all, by noticing the distress that others feel. And that takes a certain amount of courage and a certain amount of strength and inner stability before you'd even be willing to consider that. But if you're willing to take a chance and see what happens, then it kind of unfolds naturally.
I heard from a friend of mine who's a geneticist, and I don't understand three-quarters of what he says, but he did talk about genes that don't get activated, and we don't want them. They're like brakes, you know, and we don't want them to get activated, like cancer and so on and so forth. He said, but if something gets added to them, I think he said lactate or whatever it was, then they become active. And so I wonder if we can look at compassion in the same way, that if we add something to that human's formula, safety, kindness, compassion on our part, that gene gets activated.
That's a beautiful way to think about it, that actually it's not something that you learn about in isolation and you don't learn to feel compassion from a book. It's an interpersonal kind of learning that happens in the company of others. And when people trust you and you trust them, there's some kind of opportunity for an exchange of experience that lets us feel what they're feeling. And that's the basis of compassion. that when we're held in compassion by someone else, we get the idea, we realize that it's possible for us to feel that way too. And the bottom line is that it just feels better.
Yeah, it sure does. So one of the things we've learned from this wonderful research from Veronica and Tony, I mean, you use the word virus. It is like a virus. I mean, stress is all around, and we do absorb it. So now what? What do we do with the stress we've absorbed? You can't always hang up the phone or walk out of the room. Yes, Michael.
Wow. Well, boy, we're saying that at the end of the hour. I think,
Michael, you've got a whole minute here.
Okay.
Come on. Just ramble for 60 seconds.
This is the Nobel Prize here. I mean, it's a $64,000 question, but how about if we all just start by slowing down enough, taking a breath, and realizing that we're all just a little bit crazy. We're all reacting a little bit more than is necessary, and maybe we could just take a fresh start.
Yeah, and literally, Michael, literally take a breath and notice that you are breathing, literally. Literally
right.
Do that. It doesn't take a long time, and you don't have to alter your life. We're out of time, and I really want to thank all three of you. It's just fascinating work that all three of you are doing, and I look forward to reading more research. And Michael, you and I are going to be hanging out together anyway, so we'll hear what you're doing. Thanks so much, Veronica, Tony, and Michael.
Thank you,
Dan.
Next week on Voices in the Family, random mass shootings and whether we can prevent them. Well, to download our podcast, we're at whyy.org/voices. Follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. Hey, talk to me on drdangottlieb.com. I love to exchange what's happening in your life and have you check in on what's happening in mine. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Lindsay Carfagno is our summer intern. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Gita Simons is our producer. Me, I'm the host. Have a great week, my friends.